Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. I'm happy to report on a few developments related to things we've been talking about. And first of all, regarding last week's topic, we were talking about water issues, which of course have a connection to the global climate crisis. But the Government Accountability Office just released a report on Monday about water issues and what's happening to our groundwater, drinking water supplies in so many parts of the country because of fracking. And the Government Accountability Office, which is an arm of Congress and somehow miraculously has not been eliminated by the Republican Party, but certainly if they get control of Congress this fall, that might happen. Anyway, they issued this report calling on the federal EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, to step up enforcement amid water contamination and seismic activity risks associated with fracking. Because, as you know, fracking allows the high-pressure injection of water plus toxic chemicals down into the bedrock to shatter it, so that reserves of natural gas and oil can then be pushed up to the surface. So in this report, they said that the guidance EPA gives for these operations hasn't been updated since the 1980s. Now, that's significant because it was only in 2005 that fracking with toxic chemicals really was allowed to take place. And that, of course, is because of the, what's called the Halliburton loophole in the infamous Energy Act of 2005. We were well into global climate disruption by then, but the Bush and Cheney administration got pushed through the usual big packages of federal money for gas and oil exploration, hardly anything for renewable, and Cheney was able to slip in this little clause into the bill, which wasn't noticed in the media at all, and I don't know if it was noticed much in Congress, but it said, henceforth, the extraction method known as hydraulic fracturing will be removed from the jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act. And I think it said more than that, clean air and other one, too, another one. At any rate, yeah, so they're using guidelines from the 1980s. As of 2005, hundreds of fracking companies sprang up then across the country using these toxic chemicals, which make the process more effective, except for the earth and us. And this report says every day in the United States, at least 2 billion gallons of fluids, a lot of it toxic, are injected into over 172,000 wells to enhance oil and gas production or to dispose of the used fluids that are brought to the surface and then have to be pushed back down. So it says these wells are subject to regulation to protect drinking water resources. But they say the EPA needs to be doing more. It's not doing inspections. And partly this is because they don't have the funding. And the EPA said it generally agreed with these findings. They would want to be doing more. So anyway, it concluded by saying the safeguards do not address emerging underground injection risks such as seismic activity. There have been a lot of earthquakes in places they've never been because of these fracking wells. And overly high pressure in geologic formations leading to surface outbreaks of these toxic fluids. So we'll see what happens. I don't quite understand, and no one in the media addressed the disconnect between saying the EPA is responsible for taking care of this clean water as might be damaged by fracking. When you put that next to the Halliburton loophole in the Energy Act of 2005 saying, you know, the U.S. Clean Water Act doesn't apply to fracking. So maybe what the GAO is saying is there's some other way the EPA is responsible for looking after these sources of our drinking water. In any event, it's a good development. And then, regarding our ongoing topic of the global climate crisis, a big report was put out by the President's Council of Economic Advisors, and you probably saw some articles in the media about this. This was just last Monday it was released, and the title is The Cost of Delaying Action to Stem Climate Change. And they released it now because this week is the open comment period held by the U.S. EPA to receive comments from the public about the EPA's proposed rules that were announced last month to cut carbon emissions from coal-fueled power plants. So they're holding hearings right now in four cities around the country. But you can also mail in comments and email comments during this period. Anyway, the gist of the report by the Council of Economic Advisors is that with every year we continue to delay taking serious action of limiting carbon emissions, the cost of doing that will increase, and the kinds of restrictions we put in will need to be more stringent. So specifically, the report states that the cost of taking effective action will increase by 40% for every decade of delay. And I read the articles, but I was a little more curious, so I went to the report itself, which you can easily find online at whitehouse.gov, and there I found some unexpected admissions by this group of top-level economists. I mean, these are very much mainstream economists. They're not at all from the alternative team. But in the executive summary, and again in the introduction, for instance, they blithely recite the perspective that green economists and activists have been trying to get on the table for 40 years, that is, arguing for true pricing and arguing against the false model at the heart of modern economics, which, if you remember any diagrams, shows this input-output flow, and it shows that any damage to our material context, that is air, water, soil, is a mere externality. So privatizing the profits while socializing the costs of this damage to our material context and us has long been the way of doing business. And all that was ignored for decades by mainstream economists when this was brought up to them, that this is an entirely fictional model. It's just, you know, not what's really going on. But listen to this. This is what the President's Council of Economic Advisors said in this report a few days ago, that greenhouse gas emissions, especially carbon dioxide emissions, quote, harm others in a way that is not reflected in the price of carbon-based energy. That is, carbon dioxide emissions create a negative externality. And they didn't say mirror for once. Because the price of carbon-based energy does not reflect the full costs or economic damages of carbon dioxide emissions, market forces result in a level of carbon dioxide emissions that is too high. Because of this market failure, public policies are needed to reduce carbon dioxide emissions and thereby limit the damage to economies and the natural world from further climate change, unquote. Well, that is big, because carbon-based energy is certainly not the only product in our economy that has a false price on it. It's true throughout manufacturing, but also in retailing. Every single item for sale inside Walmart, for instance, comes to mind because it bears a false price. Since they externalize a lot of their labor costs onto the public welfare system for the working poor, food stamps, medical coverage, things that their employees couldn't exist without. So let's hope this really opens the door to a lot more mainstream finger-pointing at false pricing so we can get the true ecological costs built in to the way we think about how much it costs to make something. When you do that, the renewable resource people, the manufacturing that's powered by renewable resources, way undercuts the other. if everybody had to have true pricing, the fossil fuel people, this damage that they're causing with a big price tag on it makes their products not at all attractive to buy. So we shall see. Well, two more relevant reports were released on Monday. One was in the journal Nature, Climate Change. This one found that the cumulative effects of higher temperatures and ozone pollution are likely to affect photosynthesis so as to reduce the yields of staple grains such as wheat and corn. And then the last report I'll mention was released on Monday by Greenpeace, and it addressed the federal coal leasing program. As you know, President Obama, even though he's making a big push in year six of his administration, previously has opened a lot of federal land to coal mining. And this report by Greenpeace points out that it's been troubled for a long time, this program, well before his administration, should be said. But anyway, they point out that the agency's inspector general and the Government Accountability Office issued reports over the last year that criticized the Interior Department's Bureau of Land Management for selling leases at low prices, shortchanging taxpayers by tens of millions of dollars. Using the administration's own estimate for the, quote, social cost of carbon, unquote, or the damage carbon dioxide does to public health and the economy at $37 a ton, Greenpeace estimated that coal leased during the Obama administration will cause damages estimated between $52 billion and $530 billion. And how much revenue did we take in for those leases? $2 billion, $2.3 billion. So there's that, the fact that it was a horrible deal for the American public, but also it's just contributing to the crisis because this cheap coal made available by this phony low prices to go into the land, the federal land, has encouraged increased coal consumption in this country for decades, and also now we're exporting this coal elsewhere in the world, so it's only adding to the problem in a big way. So again, I was happy to see that those reports got a lot of attention in the mainstream media. But sometimes, you know, when I ponder our country's extremely minimalist response to the global climate crisis, what arises in my mind is a memory of the vast array of activist groups that formed in various sectors back in the peace movement of the early 1980s. Back then, the focus was to get rid of the 50,000 nuclear warheads that were poised for firing. We had 30,000 pointed toward Russia. They had 20,000 pointed toward us on this hair trigger computer launching system. And in that big effort, there were all kinds of organizations, not only Physicians for Social Responsibility, talking about this nuclear stalemate, this deadly situation, but also Manufacturers for Social Responsibility, Editors and Publishers for Social Responsibility, Educators for Social Responsibility, Clergy for Social Responsibility. I mean, really, it was across the board. Everybody stepped up to the plate and got into it from the where they were in society, speaking from, you know, what they know, where they are. So, yeah, the other thing that comes to mind is the unique position of one of our major institutions, and that's organized religion. I've worked with the Parliament of World Religions, United Religions Initiative, and many other activist religious organizations, and anyone could see that the potential is extremely impressive because no other institution has a presence in almost every neighborhood and at the national level and even international level. So you might well think, gee, what we really need is for someone to organize a national network of local churches committed to addressing climate change. Well, I am happy to be able to tell you that someone has done just that, and that someone is my guest today, the Reverend Canon Sally Grover Bingham, an Episcopal priest and canon for the environment in the Episcopal Diocese of California. She's been active in the environmental community for 30 years and is the founder and president of the Regeneration Project, which is focused on its Interfaith Power and Light campaign. That's their main project that this Regeneration Project does. Interfaith Power and Light, a religious response to climate change. The Interfaith Power and Light campaign includes a national network of more than 15,000 congregations with affiliated programs in 40 states. The Reverend Bingham also serves on the National Board of the Environmental Defense Fund and the Advisory Board of the Union of Concerned Scientists and Climate One. Both the Interfaith Power and Light campaign and the Reverend Bingham have received numerous awards, including her being chosen in 2012 to receive the Rachel Carson Award from the Audubon Society, the nation's premier award for women environmental leaders. The Reverend Bingham was featured in Rolling Stone as one of the leaders of the New Green Revolution, and she was named by Huffington Post as one of the 50 most powerful women religious leaders. She's also the lead author in a book entitled Love God, Heal Earth, a collection of 21 essays on environmental stewardship by religious leaders. Now, to those facts, I'd like to add just a little of the personal dimension of her work, which she wrote about in a lovely piece that's in the current issue of Earth Island Journal, that is, summer 2014. It's in their Voices column. They invited her to write about her work and how she came into it. And the interesting thing is, she was an active member of the Episcopal Church, and she was on the board of the Environmental Defense Fund, but she noticed there was nothing happening in the Episcopal Church around this big issue of protecting the creation. And so she went to seminary to become an Episcopal priest and then to develop this whole area within the Episcopal Church, which, as you've heard, has now gone beyond that to being a national network of interfaith dimensions. So I just want to read this closing paragraph because it'll help give you her perspective. Global climate change is a justice issue, a moral issue, and most importantly, a spiritual issue. How we respond to climate change demonstrates our relationship with God and our relationship with each other. Will we continue to live for ourselves alone, or will we take some responsibility for others and for future generations? I'm convinced that with everyone working together on the shared purpose of survival, we will win this most important moral challenge. So, Reverend Canon Sally Bingham, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Charlene.
I would like to orient the readers by having you tell them about the different projects that the Interfaith Power and Light campaign does. But first, I'm curious to hear about how you selected that name for the campaign.
Interfaith Power and Light, that name?
Uh-huh.
Well, it started really as Episcopal Power and Light, and I'm going to have difficulty telling you exactly how it happened, but I was in Estes Park in Colorado with a group of Episcopalians working. It was called the Episcopal Environmental Network, and this is back in 1995, about. We had already founded the Regeneration Project, which has got a mission of deepening the connection between ecology and faith, but we didn't have a serious campaign about climate. And I was walking with a colleague, and we were on a trail up there in the mountains and realized that we wanted to address climate change because it was surfacing as being the most important challenge facing our generation, and it was going to affect everything. We had other members of our committee that wanted to work on trees, and some people on water, and some people on antibiotics. But this colleague and I realized that every single one of those things was going to be affected by the changing climate, and we needed to have a campaign and focus on that particular thing. And I don't know which one of us said Episcopal Power and Light, but we were running back down the mountain saying, we've got it, we've got it.
Wow.
And to this day, I can't tell you whether Steve McCausland thought of it or whether I thought of it. We did it together.
Well, the reason I asked was I've heard people say, oh, I can't remember the name of that network Sally Bingham has. It sounds like a utility company. So,
well, that's absolutely,
you know,
correct.
It's, I guess, an easy way to remember if they get the interfaith part first, maybe.
That's absolutely correct. And some people, when they first hear the name, think that we are a utility. And it's interesting because those first 3 years, that sort of 96 up to the year 99 or 2000, when we became interfaith, we were largely asking Episcopal churches across this country to buy renewable energy for their electricity. Mm-hmm. And that's where we began. And yeah, we were asking them to either put solar on the roof, but, you know, you go back 20 years and solar wasn't as popular as it is right now, and it was a stretch to say, put solar on your roof. But we were actually able to get a lot of our congregations here in California who were Episcopal churches to go to an outside provider that wasn't Pacific Gas and Electric or Southern California Edison or one of the the monopolies that are in California. There were other companies, and you could decide if you wanted 10% of your electricity from renewables or if you wanted 50%, depending on how much you were willing to pay. And that's sort of where we started. But as I'm sure your listeners and you know, if you're going to purchase renewable energy and you pay more for it, you're going to want to use as little as possible. So we began to realize that conservation was a huge part of this and energy efficiency. So about the time that energy efficiency and conservation became a part of Episcopal Power and Light, we were getting phone calls from other denominations saying, we'd like to do this too. So by the time we had some synagogues and Jewish communities that were involved, and Presbyterians and Lutherans, we thought, well, let's make this an interfaith ministry. And so now we are, as you have said, we are in 40 states with Interfaith Power and Light programs working at the local level.
Well, I looked on your website, which is very impressive, and I see that you have four different categories of projects. Could you tell us about this Cool Congregations?
Well, what we've done is, over the years, found different ways to encourage congregations to join our program. And one of them is the Cool Congregation Program, which also has a certification coming with it that was just announced. And the Cool Congregation Program is asking congregations to practice energy efficiency, put in energy-efficient appliances, and then we offer a challenge. We give financial prizes to congregations that have they go into the contest, and the ones that have made the most progress in cutting their carbon emissions get financial rewards. And then another program that you see on our website called Cool Harvest has to do with food, faith, and climate, so that we have an educational program around how does the food get to your table, where does it come from, how is it processed, and we're trying to show congregations who have meals. You know, there's not a mainstream religion that doesn't have, whether it's Ramadan or Sunday night suppers during Lent or a Shabbat evening. Most mainstream religions have meals together. And we're trying to focus on the fact that you can have a sustainable meal. You can have locally grown seasonal food, and it's delicious. So we give recipes, we give a lot of different tools, and we usually have a different film that we focus on every year. And I think last year it was called Nourish. And people write in, sign up to be part of Cool Harvest, and then we send them a kit. And then in the kit they get all this information.
And I bet there's sort of a rippling effect into the households then for both of those, both the energy conservation and the, you know, where does our food come from and all those decisions we make.
Well, you hit on the whole purpose of our work. We want congregations to serve as examples to the community. So whether it's energy efficiency, conservation, if there's solar up on the roof, that people will say, gosh, if my congregation can do that, I bet I can do it in my home.
Uh-huh.
So we focus on the facility with the idea that people will take these tools. They'll take when a clergy person can walk down the aisle and tell his congregation or tell her congregation that they're saving money on electricity and they're creating jobs, well, people will say, gosh, if they can do it here at the church, maybe I can do it in my home.
Uh-huh.
And so, yes, of course, around the food as well. If they find out they're having delicious, healthy, sustainable meals in their congregations, they will probably want to go home and do it there, too.
Mm-hmm. Great. Now, what's this preach-in? I thought that was really interesting. A Sunday, what, in mid-February, you had a nationwide preach-in on climate change?
That's right. We do that every year. It happens right around Valentine's Day. And the idea is that we're focused on love, loving other people, whether it's your girlfriend, boyfriend, husband, wife, partner, child. We give each other cards, and it's about loving one another. Well, we have exploited that a bit, if you will, to say, let's love creation. And let's show our love for God through our behavior. So the preach-in comes up right around Valentine's Day, and it could be Friday, Saturday, or Sunday, depending on when your congregation gathers, if it's Jewish, Muslim, Christian. We have sample sermons in all those different denominations on our website, and people who are perhaps preaching about climate, clean air, or health, that's affected by both those things. If they haven't ever spoken on it before, they can get talking points and sample sermons from our website. But beyond that, the preach-in is also when, if you happen to be the leader in a congregation and you have 300 members, you go to our website and sign up for the preach-in. And you say that you have 300 members that you expect to be there on that Saturday or Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
We then send you 300 postcards. And the postcards always have a theme. And usually on the front there'll be a picture that says love creation or I'm doing my part, will you do yours? And then those postcards are addressed to, 1 year they were addressed to President Obama, last year they were addressed to whoever your senator happened to be. We leave it open so that people put their senator's name on it and then it's sent to Washington.
Uh-huh.
This time it was asking for them to support the new carbon rules coming out for coal plants that the EPA was about to announce. That was announced in June, and those postcards were asking legislators to support those rules. And we sent in 57,000 postcards.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I think the year before, the postcards were going directly to Obama asking for him to step up and really do something on climate action, which it went out in February, and of course in June he announced his climate action plan, which he's and now he's beginning to implement some of that.
I want to come back to this in the second half. We have to pause for the break, but I'm extremely interested in how you jump in there and lean on public policy, which is so crucial in any activist organization at this point. Okay, we'll pause now for the break. This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Reverend Canon Sally Bingham, founder and president of the national network called Interfaith Power and Light. Let's give them something to talk about, babe. A little mystery to figure out. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Reverend Canon Sally Bingham, founder and president of the national network Interfaith Light and Power, which has a very informative website, interfaithlightandpower.com. www.fracking.org. So let's just touch on the last of your four programs before we move into your work on public policy in this organization. Carbon Covenant, what is that?
May I just also make a correction? It's Interfaith Power and Light rather than
what
light.
What did I say?
You said light and power.
Oh, well. Okay, there it is. I'm getting confused with the utility company. So, Carbon Covenant.
Well, Carbon Covenant is a program that we set up to work with religious communities in the developing world where they've had really serious damage to forests. And our hope is that through connecting communities of faith here in the United States who will recognize how important trees are, they donate money to plant trees at these four different communities in the developing world. Mm-hmm. And one of the really interesting ones is in Cambodia, where the monks are trying to stop illegal logging.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see this on our website, is a great picture of them. They ordain the trees because people won't cut down the tree if it's been ordained. But in Kilimanjaro, which is the, it's some evangelical Lutherans who are working to put 1 million trees back up in Tanzania, and we're helping with that. And we've had some very generous people here in the U.S. who have donated money, and it doesn't take much money to plant 100 trees. A group of nuns in Minnesota gave us $10,000 to get this program started. And since that time, people can give $20 for a gift for someone else. We have most of our fundraising for the Carbon Covenant program during holiday time when people want to give a gift to someone who has everything. And they'll say, we'll plant 50 trees on Kilimanjaro as a birthday present for my aging father who has everything.
Uh-huh.
And that's how that works.
Okay. Well, let's move into another section, which I spent a lot of time poring over. I thought it was so impressive, your section labeled public policy, because a lot of times, congregations, I've been sent books to review that were about greening churches, and almost all of it's about greening the physical plant of the church building, and there's a little bit more. But I was always hoping to see that they were going as a body to the state legislature or doing other things that might help legislators understand that there's a groundswell wanting action on certain key issues. So, anyway, in your section on public policy, I was impressed that you have the policy positions very clearly spelled out and why the organization thinks these positions should be adopted for about 10 different issue areas. And then you have this section called Take Action, three things, again, very clear instructions on what people can do right now. So how does that section come to be? I mean, do you do it yourself, or is it with input from around the country? Or,
well, we stay in very close contact with some of the really large environmental organizations, as well as the science, the Union of Concerned Scientists, Environmental Defense Fund, we NRDC. We have staff that work together on a lot of these policies because in our small office in San Francisco, we don't have economists. We don't have a scientist on staff. So we really have to rely on other organizations to give us the information we need. We do. We analyze it, and we have a policy person. Susan Stevenson, who's our executive director, is very good on policy. And as you probably know, there are groups like USCAN, which is the United States Climate Action Network, they have regular telephone calls, and we get onto those calls. There's a climate action campaign going on in the Northeast, and we're always on those telephone calls. Now, I just need to to say, though, that we don't ally ourselves with the Sierra Club or NRDC or EDF, because we believe that the reason we're effective on policy is because our voices come from a theological base, that we are not environmentalists. We are religious people who understand that God called us to be the stewards of creation, that God put Adam in the garden to till it and to keep it, and that we are supposed to be the gardeners. And so we take the position that we've got a moral responsibility. This is why I call it a spiritual issue. That we have a moral responsibility to the future. We have a moral responsibility to God to maintain and really save creation. So when we go in and talk to politicians, which we do, we have an annual meeting in Washington every May. This past May, we had, I think there were 76 religious leaders who spread out all over Capitol Hill to talk to their specific legislators about moral responsibility. And I think that's what makes our organization unique. Some of the people that we talk to would probably not entertain a visit from the Sierra Club, but they will talk to priests and rabbis and ministers. So we feel that we have a very important niche to in this dialogue to save creation. We also, though, I mean, Charlene, we have to be really careful that we don't overstep our boundaries. We are a 501c3, and we can only do a certain amount of direct lobbying, and we can do a tremendous amount of advocacy, which is really education. And when I told you about the preach-in, those postcards, we provide the postcards, but individual people send them in. We don't, because we're not allowed by law to do more than, I believe it's 5% of our income on direct lobbying. So it's not a lot, and but we try to take what we can do and be as powerful with it, as we can.
Yeah. Well, when you were talking about the theological basis, that brought up another question in my mind, a burning question, actually, which I'd like to ask you, and that is the fact that polling of American citizens pretty consistently shows that about 38% of American voters do not accept the scientific evidence for evolution, and many of those same millions of voters, I don't have the exact percentage, often say, if asked, they're not interested in hearing about ecological issues, even the disruption of the Earth's climate patterns, because they believe that catastrophic natural events on Earth are a stage of the end times, which they readily welcome as God's will. So it seems to me that we have a huge political problem if such a large block of American voters would never join or support any push for greater action on cutting carbon emissions and related issues. And I know that there have been some bridge-building efforts. There was a joint project a few years ago between the National Association of Evangelicals and the Center for Health and the Global Environment at Harvard Medical School. They released a statement saying, an urgent call to action, scientists and evangelicals unite to protect creation. That was a small portion of the evangelicals. So my question is, I know there are ecological organizations within the evangelical community, which some call the fundamentalist part of that is what I'm talking about here, but they don't seem to have won over many people. And people in that community still seem to think in terms of what the late Jerry Falwell called, climate talk, that's the devil's distraction. So I know you know better than I do what organizations are out there, and what I wonder is, are there any mainstream ecological Protestant groups, which I think are the only people fundamentalist evangelicals would listen to? I mean, I know they feel some distance from the mainstream line religions, but it's their closest brethren. Are there any groups trying to engage them in dialogue about protecting the creation or shifting the thinking a little or a lot?
Yes, absolutely there are. Now, you brought up a lot of subjects in the last little bit. I'm not involved in the evolution argument. I think that, I mean, it's just, to me, really makes no sense. I mean, personally, I cannot understand at this stage of our history, human history, that there are still people who think that the Earth was created in 7 days.
Yeah.
Now, having said that, and this is with help from the evangelical community, they are ready to say to us, and we to them, it doesn't matter how we got here. We're here, and our job is to protect each other and protect the creation. And they will. And when I'm speaking on panels and things, and the evangelicals will do it too. They say, look, let's not talk about how we got here. We're here, and we have a job to do while we're here. And then I want to say, in answer to the very last thing you asked, which is, are there groups within that community who are working to save creation? Absolutely, yes. And if your listeners want to write this down, there is something called the Evangelical Environmental Network. And they were, it's out of Washington, D.C., and they were instrumental in getting mercury taken out of the pipe, the smokestacks that come out of these coal companies. And here's how they did it. Most of them are right-to-lifers, but they discovered that mercury is found in babies' cord blood, which means that babies' fetuses are being polluted before they're ever born. So they went to bat, talking to legislators, talking to the coal industry about how we want babies to be born healthy rather than polluted. And they were really creative and powerful in getting mercury regulated. And what they're doing now, in terms of when you use the broader term of climate change and carbon pollution, they're saying, Jesus said, what you do to the least of us, you do to me. And that sentence alone, coming right out of Scripture that they pay so much attention to, is attracting evangelicals to study and understand that climate change is hurting the poor people first and foremost, and that if they're going to follow Jesus, they better do something about it. And they're bringing in more and more evangelicals all along.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's a matter of whether people put more weight on the Book of Revelation or Matthew 25 and the Psalms that are cited in some of your articles. I was in line once at a fabric store about 6 years ago, and I was almost up to the cash register. There was one person in front of me, and then it was her turn, and she went up, and she seemed to know the sales clerk. So they were chatting, and I could hear. And the one, I guess she was buying curtain material or something. She says, oh, are you going to, you know, pull these back? Will they be moving on the rod or something? And she said, oh, no, I never open the curtains. Why would I look outside at nature? You know, I'm ready for the rapture. Why does, you know, kind of just dumb nature out there have anything to do with me? And I have to tell you, I was really shocked. I was standing in line. I had just moved to a new area, and I thought, uh-oh. So I just wonder what portion of the larger people who say, no, evolution's not right, we believe in a literal reading of the Bible, you know, are into that end times, and so what if the world is falling apart? That's what's supposed to happen. I would hope it's a smaller portion than we wouldn't want to have, in terms of we need the whole populace to be leaning on government because we live in a petrol state. That's why we haven't had any action. From the mid-1990s, Europe just jumped right in and started cutting carbon emissions because they weren't controlled by oil corporations. So we are way behind on doing anything. And, you know, we need people like you doing the grassroots push on legislators. And I just wonder what portion of the population, as I say, is going to sit this out because of their religious focus on Revelation?
Well, two things. I have a great friend whose name is the Reverend Richard Cizik.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if you have heard his name or not.
I certainly did. He got pushed out of his evangelical organization after a few years, didn't he, for doing too much?
Well, he spent 28 years being the representative for the government relations for the National Evangelical Association, and yes, he was pushed out, and he will tell you, and he is an evangelical, that there, nowhere in Scripture, including Revelations, is there anything that would allow you to destroy creation. There are these folks that say when the world all falls apart, Jesus will return.
Uh-huh.
But he told me that that is a very, very small group of people. They are loud,
uh-huh.
but it's a minority. It's a real
uh-huh.
minority. So the other thing I want to point out is one of our really wonderful and most engaged board members is the Reverend Gerald Durley. And Gerald was president of the Black churches in Atlanta for a long time. He didn't leave it for this reason. That was his role. But he has become a champion for climate now.
Uh-huh.
He's in his 70s, and he walked with Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me that we don't need everybody in this movement, and he said, we need a critical mass.
That's
and
right.
If there's going to be these folks that want to be Bible literalists and don't want to join the rest of mainstream religions on understanding that we are the stewards of creation, we don't need them. If we can get to the critical mass, which is what he said happened with the civil rights movement. They got to a point where they had enough people to make a difference. It wasn't everybody.
Yeah.
And that our goal shouldn't be to try to convert everybody.
Uh-huh.
But that our goal should be, just get the critical mass.
I'm so thrilled to hear that the problematic group is smaller than I thought.
Oh, yes.
This has been so interesting. We've run out of time, but I want to thank you so much for coming on the program, Reverend Canon Sally Bingham.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me, and good luck.
Thanks.
Okay,
let's go over to the Arts Corner. This week, we're going to close with a memorial tribute to Margot Adler, an NPR correspondent based in New York. You may well have heard her news stories over the years on All Things Considered, Morning Edition, and Weekend Edition. She was also an author and wrote Drawing Down the Moon, one of the major books about neo-pagan, goddess, Wiccan, nature-based religion, which went through several editions since it first came out back in 1979. She also wrote Heretic's Heart, A Journey Through Spirit and Revolution, a memoir of the 60s and 70s. She was a remarkable presence, so vital, and times with her were always memorable. Margot Adler died 3 days ago of cancer at age 68. Here's a poem about a spiritual figure who exists in Margot's three bases. Jewish, she was the granddaughter of the pioneering psychologist Alfred Adler, neo-pagan, and Unitarian Universalist. This poem is Eve by Annie Finch, from her volume of poetry, also entitled Eve. When Mother Eve took the first apple down from the tree that grew where nature's heart had been and came tumbling, circling, rosy into sin, which goddesses were lost and which were found? What spirals moved in pity and unwound across our mother's body with a spin of planets lost for us and all her kin? What serpents curved their mouths into a frown, but left their bodies twined in us like threads that lead us back to her? Her presence warms, and if I follow closely through the maze, it is to where her remembered reaching spreads. In branching gifts, it is to her reaching arms that I look, as if for something near to praise. For a memorial song, we'll hear a chant that Margot Adler sang hundreds of times, always standing in a circle of people. This is, "The earth, the air, the fire, the water returns, 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 returns." Here it is.
The earth, the air, the fire, the water return, 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 return. The earth, the air, the fire, the water return, 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 return. Aye, 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 aye.
Blessed be, Margot. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is "Let's Give 'Em Something to Talk About," sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespratnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LaCane, will be here with her guest. I'll be back 2 weeks from today on August 14th with my special program on the centenary of World War I, the tragic conflagration that set in motion so many of the dynamics we've been dealing with since then. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.
Now that we know it, let's